Hello, folks. My name is David M. Goldstein.
And I'm Brian Brinkman.
And you are listening to episode 2 of the Beyond the Pond podcast. This is a podcast in which Brian and myself use the music of Phish to introduce the listener to some other bands that, if you like Phish, we think that you would like very much. And the jam which we are going to focus on in this episode is the version of AC/DC Bag for November 21st, 1997, from the famous Hampton Coliseum in Hampton Roads, Virginia.
Awesome. Before we get started, just have a little bit of business here for you guys. Wanted to give out some support and some plugs to a few podcasts that have given us a ton of love, a ton of support, and a ton of assistance over the last couple of weeks as we've gotten started here. So definitely you guys should be checking out the Helping Friendly podcast. That is the ubiquitous Phish podcast. All Phish information that you need, go through them. Under the Scales, hosted by one and only Tom Marshall. Great stories on Phish fans and people within the Phish community, as well as a relatively new podcast, Broke Down Pod, hosted by Jonathan Hart of HF Pod, which focuses on the Grateful Dead. So definitely some great podcasts out there I would highly recommend for you guys. And then one more order of business. We want you guys to be able to find us outside of this podcast. So just a few social media ways that you can get in touch with us for feedback, for thoughts on our episodes, for requests for future jams for us to cover. You guys can find us on Gmail at beyondthepondpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at _beyondthepond. Spotify, we're posting playlists after every episode of the songs that we play, along with the jams, at least those that are available on Spotify, as well as our new album recommendations. You can find us on there at Beyond the Pond Podcast Playlist. You can sense a theme with all of this. And then finally, two more. Facebook. We've got a Facebook page that's up and live, Beyond the Pond Podcast. We'd love to interact with you guys there. And then we've got a website up that is going to start to work as a bit of a blog for us to do a little bit more writing and expanding on our thoughts on the music that we dive into, called beyondthepondfish.wordpress.com. So seek us out in all those places, and we'll be in touch.
We are very much hiding in plain sight on the interwebs. just wanted to run down some of the themes that you can expect to hear from this episode. We cover, we have Trey's fiery blues guitar, some of the cow funk that was very common out throughout 97, and most importantly, the musical genre known as shoegaze. It's you're going to be hearing much more about that later in the episode. And in addition, we're going to close out or what we consider to be some mind-blowing musical moments that we think you should pay attention to, simply because portions of this AC/DC back are absolutely mind-blowing. It's splitting your head open and letting the gray matter flow out onto the floor and the speaker as you were. But anyway, I would say, Brian, let's get to the Phish.
So as David mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to be talking about the 11/21/1997 AC/DC Bag from Hampton Coliseum. A really, really fantastic jam. Very diverse, very exploratory. Touches on a variety of full band jamming, plus some very serious moments of Trey hose jamming, if you will, that really was at its pinnacle in 1997, especially when you talk about the genre of music shoegaze that Trey was working through and Trey was channeling throughout this jam, especially in the section that we're going to play in a couple of minutes. For me, one of the reasons why we chose this jam was it's a real prime example of how dark Phish could get in 1997. But I know for you, David, a huge reason of it was the shoegaze element.
Yeah, as will become evident as we play it, there's a portion of this jam we're going to focus on that just gets incredibly dissonant. It gets incredibly loud, and there are lots of effects pedals involved. And like you said, Phish was not always roses and hippies and ganja goo balls. It could get pretty dark at times. I know we're going to explore some darkness in some future episodes of this show. But yeah, if you happen to be at Hampton Coliseum during parts of this AC/DC bag and under the influence of something or other, I'm really not entirely sure how you got home that night, let alone out of the Hampton Coliseum. That's how dark some of it gets. In terms of the significance of the show, we could say this is certainly night one of a phenomenal two-night Hampton 1997 run. It was a four-song second set. And I don't know about you, Brian, but I kind of prefer night one to night two, although it's sort of splitting hairs, would you say?
I'm right there with you. Night one has always taken the cake for me. It was my first Fall 97 tape, and as much as I love elements of 11/22, I can throw on night one at pretty much any time.
Yeah, I mean, as an example of how Phish was at the peak of their powers in Fall 1997, they decided to open the show with the first ever cover of the semi-obscure Rolling Stones disco song Emotional Rescue. And it almost felt like a dare, because then they stretched it out to 18 minutes. Like, they're on the tour bus listening to the record, and they're like, you know, why the heck don't we play this song to start the show and have Mike sing falsetto, and fuck it, we'll make it 18 minutes long. And they did that, and it was great.
It's kind of the jamming that comes out of it is kind of the prime example of something I remember reading in, I think it was the Phish book, where Trey said what made Fall 97 so special was they started listening to themselves on the tour bus. And I wonder if this was like an example of them listening to a section of like the Denver Ghost and equating it to this obscure Stone song. The funny thing is how this song has kind of lingered throughout Phish's history and just followed them. And I was lucky enough to catch it at the Fuck Your Face show back in 2012. Never expected to see this song whatsoever, but it always seems to kind of pop up at these quirky little shows. There's I think it's Bonner Springs 98. There's an Emotional Rescue. I could be getting that off by a show or two, but I think that's the one. There's that Vegas show, 9/30/2000, that it shows up at. It just kind of follows them in weird, weird spaces.
Yeah, it's one of those Mike-led covers that seemed like a good idea at the time and actually was.
Yeah.
For examples of ones that weren't, you got Free Man in Paris, or cover of Brian Eno's All Come Running, which you like more than I do, but I wasn't really feeling it. But no, it's and to follow that up with a 13 minute split open and melt, it's they're throwing down.
Yeah. I would say as well, one of the other big significance of this show and prime reason why we're doing this, this was the first ever AC/DC bag jam, and for a song that similar to Choctaw's Torture that we talked about in our last episode, that was such a reliable opener and you know, 6-7 minute rocker, to suddenly jam in the way that it did, and leading from here to a really phenomenal short but really funky version on 12/7 that seeped into Psycho Killer. We all know about the 12/30 MSG version, and we all know about the Boise 99 version. I was really fortunate to catch them jam this. One of the few musical highlights that I remember at Coventry was this AC/DC bag jam. And for nothing else, I was just happy to see a bag that went deep, because this has always been one of my favorite. This Hampton version has always been one of my favorite jams of all time from Phish.
Yeah, this is the first one I mean, there were definitely some that were a little longer, a little faster, but in terms of going full on, like 20-minute plus type two, this was the first one to do that.
Yeah, I think there's there's a version from Deer Creek the year before. I think it's another live fish release that is like 11 or 12 minutes, but it's very much within the theme of AC/DC bag. So this was cool. From a historical standpoint, you know, just to give context of where we're at right now with fish. So, as we mentioned, this is at Hampton Coliseum. This was their third show ever, I want to say, at Hampton. They did a November 95, October 96, and then this run. Is that correct?
I think so.
Yeah, okay. From here on out, they would do some pretty storied runs. So, something about playing there this weekend really just hit it for them. But it's amazing to think this was night six of fall 97. So this has been led into by that incredible four-song second set in Utah, the Denver Ghost, the Champagne Wolfmans, and Makisupa Policemen. I mean, all these highlights that could, you know, dot any modern tour have taken place already in the first week of this tour. It's pretty amazing.
That Wolfman's Makisupa, that's the filler on the live fish, which comprises the Denver show at the Incredible Ghost, I think.
Yeah, you're correct.
I think, yeah, you get that whole Denver show, plus you also, right, get the crazy Wolfman's Makisupa. And I've been able to listen to it in Spotify, but because all the plastic went on to my CDs, from that show I haven't played in years, and that really pisses me off. Not smart fish. Anyway,
it's you know, as we were saying earlier, this is a precursor to 11/22/97, which is rightly so an all timer for many fans. Anytime you have Mike's Hydrogen, Weekapog, Harry Hood open a show, and I say anytime as if it's happened multiple times, but yeah, there was a reversal version 12/11/99. Very, very rare way to open a show, as well as that phenomenal Haley's Tweezer, Black Eyed Katie. Really, really incredible show the next night. And
yeah, that was back in the day when we thought Haley was going to be like 20 minutes plus forever.
Right.
Shed a tear.
We still have Bethel 2011 version. That's a fantastic 12-minute long jam. I'll hold on to that. But I know what you mean. From a geographical standpoint, they've literally done a cross-country start to a tour, and they're just going to spend 3 weeks heavily touring the East Coast. It's one of the quirks of this tour that I really like when you look at it on a map, is you get Vegas, Utah, Denver, Champaign as your only Midwest stop, really, and then Hampton. And for the next 3 weeks, they're playing as hot as they've potentially ever played. You know, a lot of people will make the argument that this is the strongest tour fish has ever played. I think that can be saved for a different day. It is a phenomenal tour front to back. No, don't get me wrong. But the fact that the majority of the tour, much like December 1995, is spent just charting the Northeast and the East Coast is part of its lore, I think. You know, it's just, it covers all their home turf.
Yeah, this is back when they did, they had Thanksgiving runs, and I remember going to Thanksgiving with my grandparents and folks, and then going to the Worcester shows. Actually, in between, I don't know what it was November 26, 97, that was the fantastic Hartford show. Then I think it was Thanksgiving, and then the next day was the two Worcester shows. I did two out of those three. All those shows were fantastic. The Hartford show is fantastic. And then, of course, eventually there's classics in Dayton, Ohio. There's the two tour closers in Albany, which are both phenomenal. It's fish playing at an extremely high level. I mean,
we can't not mention 12/2/97 set two, my personal favorite set of the entire tour.
Yes, that was the Yamar Mikes with the crazy, crazy drums. Also, great December.
Symbol. Yeah.
December 3rd, 97, arguably a top five David Bowie. Yeah. Yem, first set closer, punch you in the eye. Funk jam out of Possum for no apparent reason other than the fact that they just felt like playing a funk jam. That was, that two-night Philly run.
12.5 has like a 17 minute Julius and a 17 minutes or no, like a 21 minute slave to the traffic.
Oh, that was back. Just that like, was the type Julius. Yes. The type two Julius, the swinging Julius. Just, all right.
Just amazing what they were doing. And yeah, we could do just an entire episode on this, but, save it for another time. Unbelievable tour. One quick final note just about Hampton. As I said, this is their third show, 11/21 at Hampton. Hampton became the site of many, many great Phish shows. 11/21/98, 12/18/99, the return in 3/6/2009, as well as more recently 10/20/2013 with an absolutely phenomenal second set that gave us a preview of Wingsuit out of that tweezer, had a really great golden age, the Piper into Taking Care of Business, just phenomenal stuff.
And then, of course, the incredible Dead shows from 1989, the famous Former of the Warlock shows, October 8th, 1989, and October 9th, 1989, with the big Dark Star breakout on 10/9, and also there was a Help Slip Franklin's breakout on 10/8. Dead shows are something a bit more for the Broke Down Pod, but we would be remiss not to mention that just because those shows are so goddamn legendary.
Absolutely. So clearly this run, it means a lot to us. It means a lot to a lot of Phish fans everywhere. What are some of your memories just of this jam? I know that you had touched on a bit earlier at the start of this podcast.
Okay. Fall 1997, I was a freshman at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Obviously, in 1997, you didn't have the ability to get the show within 5 minutes of them finishing it up on Live Phish. But I had a pipeline. I was able to get the tapes relatively quickly. So I probably had an XL2 of this show maybe about 6 or 7 days after it occurred. And I popped in the second set. And I just remember writing a term paper. And during the part of the AC/DC bag jam that we are going to showcase, the shoegaze heavy molten lava part, I remember freezing and turning my head and looking at my speakers saying, "What is this? Why is there molten lava flowing out of my speakers at this time?" Like, I think I'm not even sure if I've ever done that for any. I was just frozen thinking, what the hell is going on? This is incredible. And also, we had this thing in terms of making J cards for the tapes. You made most of them on a computer. And I kind of tried to have the font reflect like the style of the show. Sometimes I would use Dom Casual or, but for this one, I definitely remember this J card being in, it was Arial italicized bold, because to say they're not messing around, this is something that you have to listen to, you have to see. So, and I thought that font kind of reflected that.
I love it. We're separated by a few years, and I got into Phish in the summer of 2001, and I got into them with a weird show, 11/17/1994, that has a phenomenal first set. But I remember as I started collecting tapes and the Live Phish series came out and I was reading the Phish book, for whatever reason, I was really intrigued by this 1997, just the whole funk era. And the idea that this band that was so happy-go-lucky and, such a hippie band, if you listen to, like, 1994, summer 1994 jams, felt like a relatively happy group, could really go dark and deep and get this really, serious funk exposure going. And I had a friend who passed me along this show. I had always heard of 11/22 as being the show to get, so I was a bit disappointed. At the same time, this being my first Fall 97 show, I was like, all right, I just got to throw it on. And I remember throwing on the second set in particular, and that minimalistic, really rhythmic build in The Ghost, where you go from Denver, where it kind of touches all corners of the musical map, to this very focused, very tight, very minimalistic jam out of Ghost Four Nights Later. And then similar to you, when that bag came on, and I'd always heard AC/DC Bag as just this, you know, 8 minute long song, feeling my head crack open while listening to it, just totally showcased a completely different way that Phish could play music. I had heard long jams before this, the Saratoga Down with Disease from 1995, recently released live Phish set. That rings a bell as a tape I got early on, but that kind of jamming never totally stuck with me until later, once I got deeper into Phish. So to hear this really melodic and exploratory jamming just blew me away out of the AC/DC Bag. And I'll never forget that. It was a very big turning point for me in terms of listening to Phish.
I think at this point we've hyped it up to the point where it's going to be impossible to live up to anyone's expectations. But we got to play it.
Let's do it.
So let's do it. That wasn't bad at all. I very much enjoyed that. That was that was as good as I recall it being all the times I have listened to it. Now, one of the reasons that we had wanted to specifically showcase this AC/DC bag is to talk to the listeners about a subgenre of alternative rock known as shoegaze music. So essentially, shoegaze was a subgenre of rock that it had its origination in the United Kingdom in the late 80s. And it's characterized by heavy guitar distortion and a blurring of all the individual components of the song, resulting in a giant wall of distortion and sound. And with the vocals, as opposed to being up front and center, were just another part of the mix, often of the sort of wispy and or like whispery variety. And when people talk about shoegaze music, they usually say things like swirling guitars and creamy massive noise. And the idea is that you're supposed to be standing in a big field at like a British music festival like Glastonbury or Tea in the Park. And I don't think Coachella or Lollapalooza have anything on gigantic, big, huge British music festivals. And then have the distortion just wash over you like a blanket. And to get this overdriven sound requires lots of effects pedals on stage. So when these bands played live, they'd be focused on the banks of pedals at their feet, thus staring at the stage. So the British music press latched onto the term shoegazing because these bands were literally focused on their shoes while they were on stage. And some of the more notable bands of the genre include My Bloody Valentine, which we are going to discuss at length. They're sort of seen as the archetype. Other bands would include Ride, Slow Dive, I guess early Verve, not so much Urban Hymns, but certainly their first album, Storm in Heaven. And some American examples of shoegaze might include the band Galaxy 500, and even the Smashing Pumpkins, whose early and best albums were very much indebted to shoegaze, piling up tracks upon tracks of guitars in the studio. And that's not really a coincidence, because I know the music engineer Alan Mulder, who helped produce My Bloody Valentine's album Loveless, also mixed Siamese Dream and many other British noise rock acts throughout the 90s and 00s going forward. And I think the best way to kick this off would be to play what many kind of consider to be the prototypical shoegaze song from the prototypical shoegaze band, My Bloody Valentine. So right now we're going to play a few seconds of their song Only Shallow. Little background on My Bloody Valentine. What you heard there, their guitarist is a guy by the name of Kevin Shields, who's been known for being quite the perfectionist. He's the one responsible for piling on tracks upon tracks upon tracks of guitar noise and distortion. And he is such a perfectionist and such a curmudgeon that the album that's from, Loveless, came out in 1991. My Bloody Valentine didn't put out another record until, I want to say, 2014. And that album was called MBV. It was like the Guns N' Roses Chinese Democracy of just of shoegaze albums. They kept saying it was going to come out. Tracks were scrapped, thrown away, and finally something came out, and it was fantastic. But just briefly, I would like to say that certainly Trey Anastasio has an affinity for My Bloody Valentine in particular with this song. It was actually rumored for years that he wanted to play the album Loveless on Halloween, get a bunch of effects pedals, get a bunch of amps because he loved it so. And that's actually borne itself out twice in Phish history. On this has only recently been made aware to me by friend of the pod, my good friend PJ Rudolph. On May 21st, 1997, Trey and Mike, they played a gig at what was Club Toast in Burlington under the moniker New York, where I think they had some sidemen also who might have been in one of Trey's solo projects. It was a very loose, very garage rocky gig where he and the band attempted a version of Only Shallow, which isn't particularly good, but it's clear that they liked the song. And Phish even tried to sort of play it tongue-in-cheek in July of 1998, and they were playing a show in Italy. I believe this was part of the sound check. It was kind of a karaoke hybrid sound check where they picked a lucky person from the audience to come up and try to sing what Trey called the My Bloody Valentine classic, Only Shallow. And that didn't go off particularly well. It's more of a curio in Phish history. But clearly, Trey's aware of the genre. He likes the song very much. I know, Brian, that you weren't quite as familiar with shoegaze music as I was. How would you compare, I guess, Only Shallow to the song that we're going to play next?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've done such a deep dive in shoegaze over the last couple of weeks as we've been planning this episode. And for me, you know, an album like Loveless probably wouldn't click until you turn your car stereo or your record player, wherever you're playing it, up as loud as it possibly can go. And just like you were saying earlier, letting the distortion and the effects just wash over you like complete waves. It's amazing how layered all of this music sounds when you're actually listening to it in depth, and when you're listening to it at a really, really high volume. My Bloody Valentine to me is still somewhat challenging, as much as I really enjoy it. You know, the melodies are kind of, and we'll talk about this sort of sensation that comes out of shoegaze here in a little bit, but the idea that, like, there's this one droning melody that kind of drives through all of the noise and the distortion, and you have to, like, find it. But there's also this other music on this large, large spectrum of sound that you want to hear as well. And so for me, My Bloody Valentine is really like the extreme of what this genre can be. Whereas a band like Ride and a song like Leave Them All Behind takes that element of shoegaze and kind of repurposes it in a more accessible way, and really writes a song around it, where like a song like Only Shallow kind of can serve as a jam almost. And a lot of what My Bloody Valentine does, I feel like, could be extended by 20 or 30 minutes and you wouldn't necessarily mind nor notice. Stuff particularly by Ride, a song like Leave Them All Behind, as well as the song In a Different Place, are really true songs that are really beautiful and are really well structured, but also implement loads and loads of effects that make them sound a little bit closer to the Smashing Pumpkins, but have a little bit more of like a Byrds Britpop element to them in different places.
All right, so let's get to that song. This is we're going to play Leave Them All Behind by Ride, which is the lead-off track from their second album, Going Blank Again, from which I believe was 1991. so that was Leave Them All Behind by Ride. And once again, I just wanted to say that the reason that we happen to be showcasing this shoegaze music is that it's really the feeling we get from the most intense part of the Hampton AC/DC bag from 1997, where Trey is just using layers upon layers of distortion and effects for 3 to 4 minutes. He keeps going and going. It splits your head open, and it's simply letting the noise wash over you, and it feels extremely good, I must say. We're going to play at least one more song. Yeah, we have one more song, which we think kind of captures a sort of, I guess, more gentler, more like whimsical side of shoegaze. This is actually from a band that they could be mistaken for British, but they're very much from the States. At least, well, I should say 2/3 of them are. The front man is actually born and raised in Australia, but they're thought of as an American band. Brian?
Yeah, Galaxy 500, they're a bunch of Harvard grads. I believe they all went to Harvard. Is that, am I right about that?
Yeah, Dean Warham and then Damon and Naomi, all Harvard.
They put out 3 records in the late 80s, early 90s. This one, Today, which is the record that we're going to play our song off of, as well as On Fire, are just absolute classics. Really work well in the shoegaze via songwriting category. Funny little embarrassing side note, I discovered Galaxy 500 by accident. I started a music blog about 10 years ago called The Suffering Jukebox, tribute to a wonderful Silver Jews song. I was reviewing an album by a band named Cite from San Francisco. Are you familiar with them, Dave?
I'm actually not.
Okay. I think you would enjoy very spiraling guitar solos, great melodies, somewhat like 60s psychedelia without being too overpowering and or too overwrought. Anyway, they end their album from 2010, Dream Get Together, with a song called Tugboat that really, really resonated with me. And I spent about the last half of the review writing about how it was a evolutionary step forward in their songwriting and blah, 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 and this fantastic moment for them, and posted a link to a forum at which someone immediately commented, Tugboat's not a Cite song.
Son, it's a cover.
And I heard that by, you know, as musical forms will be, about 15, 20 other people kept piling on and saying, don't you know Tugboat's not a Cite song? Don't you know? You know, and finally someone stepped in and said, can we just tell him who this song is by? And so I had to seek it out. And once I sought out Galaxy 500, I was totally taken by him. I was in a very early Yolo Tango obsession, and they have a very similar feel to the kind of fuzzy pop that you get from Yolo Tango. So anyway.
That presses all my buttons. I'm going to seek that out right away.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah. So we're going to play Don't Let Our Youth Go to Waste, which is a really great Galaxy 500 song. Great lyrics, great guitar solo that is really, really reminiscent of a lot of the peaks that guitar-led peaks that Trey had throughout most of Fall 97. I mean, you think of a bunch of Isabellas that were played. I'm thinking about a couple of tweezers that were thrown out. You think about that Slave from 12/5/97 that we were talking about earlier. This, where Trey just completely takes the guitar by the horns and just drives the band up to a complete peak. The Prince Caspian from 12/12, they all come to mind. So Don't Let Our Youth Go to Waste. This is a really great Galaxy 500 song we're going to listen to now. I could bleed in sympathy with you.
I can drink up everything you have. Don't let our youth go to
once again, that was Galaxy 500, Don't Let Our Youth Go to Waste, off of the record Today. We've got one more segment of music that we want to go over. As we talked about at the top of the show, there's a real mind-blowing aspect to, from a musical standpoint, to this AC/DC bag jam. And we want to feature a couple songs that, while stylistically might be different, similarly blew both David's and my mind when we were young listeners. But before we do that, we want to talk a bit about new albums. Dave, what have you been listening to lately?
Let's see. The one I picked out is the new record by a doom metal band from Little Rock, Arkansas called Pallbearer. I guess generally the genre to which they pledge allegiance is very heavy riffing, slow moving molasses type music, usually with these like rally Cookie Monster vocals. Well, what kind of sets Pallbearer apart is that while the tempos certainly are slow and the riffage is very heavy, there's lots of elements of, I guess you could say, 70s and 80s prog rock that I like. A lot of things that remind me of Rush. There's lots of Yes. It gets very Pink Floyd-y. And the singer, instead of doing more of a growl, he has very clean vocals. That's kind of split the difference between a young Ozzy Osbourne and Jeff Tate, who was the singer for the band Queensryche, who's kind of a somewhat corny 80s, 90s prog rock band that still exists, but they kicked him out because that's what prog rock bands do. When they get old, they switch members. But yeah, I mean, anyone who's looking for, I guess, an album that is both, it unfurls slowly, it's heavy, it has a lot of variety, and each time I listen to it, I notice, you know, I kind of notice other things, and it's, I could see them having some mainstream success because despite being extremely heavy, it's pretty accessible, and I would recommend it highly.
Right on. They got a pretty brutal review recently from Pitchfork, didn't they?
Yeah, I suppose they got a 6 from Pitchfork. The albums, the two albums before it were reviewed much more favorably. I think the guy's out of his mind. I think the record's great. People who I know and trust who listen to metal music as much as I listen to Fish think it's one of like the best albums of the past 10 years. So I'm just inclined to say Pitchfork's not gospel. Pallbearer, Heartless, get it. Listen to it.
I'm right on with that. I completely there are certain records that I will download, I'll love them, and then I'll just kind of go back and see what the review is, and always be shocked at where my taste didn't align, where the gospel was wrong. Very cool. I'm definitely going to be checking that out. We'll need some intense music over the next couple of weeks. I selected a record by Craig Finn, the lead singer of The Hold Steady, put out a record this year called We All Want the Same Things. I saw him open up for Japandroids about a month ago, and, you know, like so many opening acts, he didn't get the full service of sound from the venue, of lights. He didn't have the crowd at their full attention, but he did everything that he could to reach out to every member of the audience and hit everyone in a really, really powerful way. It was a fantastic show. Completely blew me away, blew my expectations of the overall night. And his record came out about 2 weeks ago, I want to say, and it's just unbelievable. It's very Springsteen-esque, but with some really wonderful fuzzy guitar lines behind it. It almost reminds me in certain places of that most recent Sufjan Stevens record, just in terms of the plain monotony narration of day-to-day life, thinking about God in Chicago in particular. Similar in some cases to Benji by Sunkill Moon, one of my favorite records of the last couple of years. But in particular, the songs, the opener, Jester in June, Preludes, as well as God in Chicago are just some fantastic songs, some of my favorite songs I've heard this year thus far. Unbelievable stuff.
I've got it on my phone. It's all queued up. I absolutely will have to get to it this week.
Yeah, it's definitely worth it. All right, so like we said at the top, one of the big aspects of this jam for us is the fact that not only does Phish play for a really long time, not only is there a very diverse jamming, not only is there a heavy shoegaze element that really ties into a style that the band has, especially Trey, has a lot of affinity for, but there's a really mind-blowing aspect to this jam. As someone in both of our situations early in our listening career of Phish, this was the kind of jam that really showed you what the band could do. And for me, I know that, you know, we had talked about this a bit before recording this podcast, David. There's something about this jam that kind of pushed you to continue exploring Phish, to continue listening to Phish, to continue being open to whatever the band was capable of. And so we wanted to showcase a couple of songs that by different bands and totally different genres that kind of had a similar effect. For me, the song I wanted to focus on was the lead track off of Animal Collective's 2009 album, Meriwether Post Pavilion, titled In the Flowers. For me, I remember when this album came out in the winter of 2009. I just graduated from college. I was getting ready to move to Korea, and I was at a, I was intentionally trying to learn as much as I could in a short amount of time about newer music. And when I say that, what I mean is I'd kind of reached a point where I was kind of sick of the rotation I was in with music, and I also consciously knew there was I was really open to more exploratory sounds and more kind of difficult music that I'd have to give multiple tries to, and I'd have to, you know, really listen to over and over and over again to really kind of understand. And I remember seeing this record come out, knowing the band, but never really dipping my toe into what they did. And I remember throwing this record on and hearing this song that fuses industrialized noise with these kaleidoscope vocals, these spacious melodies, and it just immediately reconstructed what I thought a pop song could be. From there, it really introduced me to a period of life where I had extreme musical exploration, and I was really never the same listener after this. One of the things I love about this song above all else is it feels like household appliances playing pop music. It's just, it sounds like such a natural part of your day-to-day life, but then it has this melody that kind of drifts in and out of the song that just absolutely incredible. So should we give this a listen?
Absolutely.
Cool.
Flowers by Animal Collective. I will say that I think that Meriwether Post Pavilion is the best Animal Collective record. That was sort of the album that really got me to stand up and take notice of them and go back through their other albums. I think it's still probably my favorite. In terms of mind-blowing music, one thing that I had wanted to select was sort of the entire album, but in particular the second movement off of the 1968 Miles Davis album In a Silent Way, which in its original form consists of two, I want to say, between 18 and 20 minute songs. All throughout high school and college and even elementary school, I had played trombone in various jazz bands. I still have one in my closet, take it out from time to time. And I was sort of, you know, led to believe growing up jazz, it was like Miles Davis kind of blue, Oliver Nelson blues in the abstract truth, you know, basically, I guess you could say tasteful acoustic brass instruments, well, like bass and drums. And at that point, my freshman year of college was in 1997. I mean, I had never heard anything from what I learned to become was Miles Davis's Electric Period. So it's almost a bit of a cliche. A guy I met that year in my dorm, my buddy Mark Lasis, who I still stay in touch with from time to time. He's a very successful attorney out in Colorado. Hey, Mark, if you happen to be listening. I met this guy because we both like fish and we both traded tapes. Go figure. So one Saturday evening, he had me over in his dorm room, and he was just playing records. And he's like, "Have you heard this? Have you heard this? Have you heard this?" It was dark. The lookout, there may have been some kind of substances ingested at some point. I don't entirely know. But when he put in this Miles Davis CD, it was absolutely unlike anything I had ever heard, anything I could ever consider jazz being. And in particular, the second movement, which is the title track, In a Silent Way / It's About That Time. It has a portion where it's just one continuous drum beat driven by the famous fusion drummer Tony Williams. And there's a Fender Rhodes bit played by Chick Corea that it kind of sounds like the keyboard, the Rhodes, is just like descending on your head. It's a slow descending pattern. And I remember looking up at the ceiling and seeing what looked like painted over asbestos patches or someone cutting corners with some painting in this old college dorm room and just thinking that they were clouds and that the Fender Rhodes is falling on my head. And I just looked around. It almost looked like there were patterns and strobes in the room, and it blew my mind. It still does to this day. It's easily one of my favorite albums of all time. And if there's anything you garner from this podcast, listeners, it's listen more Miles Davis. Please, please get as much as you can. And we're going to play a segment from that song right about now. Okay, folks, just to recap the songs that we played throughout this episode that sort of reminded us of themes of the Hampton AC/DC bag. The first one was Only Shallow by My Bloody Valentine off of the Loveless album from 1991. The second song was Leave Them All Behind by Ride off of the album Going Blank Again. The third song was Don't Let Our Youth Go to Waste by Galaxy 500 off of the album entitled Today.
And then in our mind-blowing music segment, we had In the Flowers from Animal Collective off of Merriweather Post Pavilion and In a Silent Way from Miles Davis off of the same name album. All of this stuff, again, you guys can find on our Spotify playlist, Beyond the Pond podcast playlist. In terms of where to find us, once again, I'll say this one more time, we would love to hear from you guys, thoughts, feedback, jam ideas, anything. Reach out to us, give us a line, give us a a review on iTunes. Would definitely help us. It's something we'd love to hear from all of you guys. You can reach us at Gmail at beyondthepondpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at _beyondthepond, Facebook Beyond the Pond Podcast, and our WordPress site is beyondthepondfish.wordpress.com.
And at this point, I think our publishing structure, we're looking to have an episode up every other Tuesday. That's subject to change. We could do more or less, but that's what we're going for right now. And once again, we remind you that we're still pretty new at this thing. This is a work in progress, but we very much hope you enjoy it. And we hope you're back in two Tuesdays so we can go beyond the pond.